The concept of impermanence is completely central to the Buddhist system, and in many ways to at the root of all of the yogic systems. But we don't talk a lot about why it's central in many ways or where it came from. And because in a certain way, impermanence as a doctrine or as a perspective is was in response to something. So I think it illuminates a bit the practice around impermanence to know what it was a response to. And what it was a response to was a debate or a search or an inquiry that was happening through the period of the Upanishads and the time of the Buddha, which you can call roughly 500 years before the Common Era, so 2,500 years or so ago. And this is the period where both the streams of practice that would become much later would become Buddhism and Hinduism and Jainism, all were starting. And the many different streams of that would become aspects of Hinduism, like Vedanta or yoga itself or Sankhya, also were starting, you know, all around the same time. And all growing out of, we can feel this kind of bed of idea and speculation that that grew out of, or we see the earliest record of in texts called the Upanishads, part of the Vedic system, the end of the Vedic system. And so all of this was being chewed on all at the same time, and one of the big things that was being investigated was what, in to use like Judeo-Christian language, European-American language, we would call a question about the existence of the soul. So the word was Atman. It often gets translated as self, but not in a psychological way, more in a like, do you have, here's the question version, do you have a singular, unique, eternal, unchanging essence that belongs to you individually and is yours for all of time and space, right? So I grew up Catholic, and the answer in that system was yes, right? You do have this. Like, once you come into being, you have this soul. You have your immortal soul, and that's what it is. And based on your actions in this lifetime, that soul either lands in a place of tremendous blessing or tremendous lack of blessing after you die. So many different versions of that story exist, lots of different ways in different traditions of enunciating how that happens. You may have grown up Jewish, some of you, and I know some of you did, and you know the concept of like your name being written in the book of life. So what does that mean, right? On all of these concepts point to an intuition that many different cultures have had, that there's something about you that's truly you forever. And so after you die, that thing that is deeply you, and it's not the body necessarily, and there's lots of complexities around the body's relationship to that soul thing, but that thing does something. It continues in some way. And then, of course, since it's a question, the other option is or not, right? The modern materialist or atheistic perspective, one of the perspectives around there, is that it does not. Or that's a different way of saying there isn't one, right? You don't have an eternal thing that continues after your death. The thing that you call yourself, that is conscious, is a product of the coming together of the conditions of this body and chemistry and perception and mapping of the world. And when you die, those conditions dissolve, and it's over. So that's also a perspective. So this question was being debated heavily around this time. And there were schools of thought that went both ways, right? Some schools of thought said, yes, you totally have a personal essence that is eternal, called it the Atman. Other schools of thought said, no, you don't have that. You think you do, but that's just totally an illusion. Some schools said, you don't have it, and nothing like that exists in the universe. Other schools said, you don't have it, but there is one thing that has it, and we call that God, or or ultimate essence, or big Atman, Brahman was one name for that. All these different ideas. And so then the Buddha shows up in the middle of this debate with all these teachers going around. And he says this. He doesn't say, there is not that thing, or there is that thing. What he says is, every possible experience you can have, everything that happens, every phenomena, so this means like phenomena through the senses, like I see something, I hear something, I sense something, I have a feeling, an intuition, I have a thought, I have a complex experience that is a blend of all of those in relationship, in the world, all the stuff we experience. He said, every single thing is marked by these qualities. And these qualities are impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the absence of an Atman, the absence of self. So notice that this is a very careful formulation. It doesn't say there is no Atman, no self. It says every particular experience you have can't have that, because it's impermanent. And so, of course, the place where this becomes the most potent is in relation to what I call myself. And so, you know, I have this 2-year-old. People tell me I was once 2. I don't really remember. But there's these amazing photographs of this little person, cute little guy. People are like, that's you. And I'm like, I trust you. You know, but I have these vague memories of being other kinds of small, older than that. But I'm not that anymore, you know. And any part of my body that I really isolate, I can't find that eternal soul in it, right? I could go blind and I'd still be myself. So it's not in the seeing. I could become paralyzed and I would still be myself. So it can't be in the sensing. I could lose a limb, and I'd still be myself. And so it can't be in the limb. And so then there's this hunch. Oh, well, maybe there is a soul, but it's not in the body at all. I could lose my life, and it's not in the body, therefore it would go on. But then the instruction gets subtler, right? It says anything you can experience is marked by that, because it changes, right? I talked about this a handful of weeks ago. We were like, we did a little exercise. We can do it again tonight. It's both an impermanence and a sort of like what is myself kind of exercise. And it was, and this is really a liberation exercise. It was, think of your first crush. Think of the person. I'll assume it was a person. But, you know, you could go like pet you fell in love with. That works. Anything, really. But you think of your first crush, and you think of the feelings that were present with that contact. Oh, my God, they looked at me. I'm dying, right? Mine was in seventh grade. Seventh grade was tremendously awkward. So, you know, when my crush asked me, what would you do if I kissed you? And I had to come up with an answer, right? It wasn't just do it. It was just like, what would you do? And I was like, is this hypothetical? I was that kind of seventh grader. So all sorts of feelings, you know. And the reflection. So go ahead and think of your being. Think of that first crush. And see if you can remember the feelings. And notice, probably, you know, I don't know all of you that well, but my guess is that those exact feelings are no longer here. When you think of that person, you no longer get Twitter-pated and spun inside. Where did those feelings go? This is an exercise that's about the end of grasping and what it means to be liberated from the passions, right? Nothing in this exercise says that it was wrong to have the crush, or that crushes are inevitably unsatisfying. It simply says, that happened, and now it's not happening. In other words, you matured, right? More or less. And you might be like, yeah, but I just went on to the next one and the next one and the next one, and they all have that kind of same feeling. And the inquiry would be, do they? Are they really all the same? Or is it actually a little bit different every time? And if it's a little bit different every time, what if you're a little bit different every time? And in a certain way, how could you not be? Right? It was one thing to have a crush in the era of, you know, what were the bands? INXS, Duran Duran, Oingo Boingo. That was my crush soundtrack, junior high. And it was another thing, you know, 10 years later to have a crush. And, you know, and my soundtrack was Steve Reich and, you know, Frank Zappa. And that was a different crush. It's a whole different world with that music playing. And 10 years after that, a whole different crush. And, you know, Digweed. Or whatever, you know. Like, so it actually can never be the same. There's a modern Zen teacher, Shunryu Suzuki, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, who described his own realization of freedom in terms of this. He said, everything was just going along, practicing, it was all ordinary, and then suddenly I just realized just this: no moment is ever repeated. No moment is ever repeated. That was it. That was his liberation realization. And so this is impermanence. This is the mystery of feeling like a self, even though the thing that feels like a self is constantly changing. So then the question there is, if it's constantly changing, how can it be me? Or a different version of that question would be, if what I am is a constantly changing phenomena, but I still feel like a self, what are the implications of that? So the teaching impermanence said everything is marked by impermanence. Marked is the translation. The word is lakana or lakshana in Sanskrit. There's three of them, right? Impermanence, unsatisfactoriness gets translated as suffering also, and not self or the absence of atman, anatman or anatta. And they're called tilakana, the three marks. Also gets translated as the three characteristics. But I like marks, like it's a, like there's a tattoo or a brand, a branding. I mean like branding like on a cow, branding, you know, on things. Meaning like, here's this lovely tea. The heat that it was first manifesting is now gone. And the pleasure of the perfect temperature is also now gone. The cup is lovely, and the cup is still whole. But if any part of me really hooked onto that cup as being deeply precious, eventually I'll be disappointed, sooner or later. And of course, one has a 2-year-old, so things happen sooner. It's a good reminder, but it's not necessary in a certain way. Impermanence is true whether something seems to last 1,000 years or a few minutes, or a mind moment, a flickering moment of perception. So the Buddha's emphasizing impermanence was a way of saying all this conversation that is searching for permanence, right? This whole conversation about the self and about like finding eternal peace. Part of what I hear in his emphasis in the tradition's emphasis on impermanence is that whole search, which in a way like the search for God, the search for the soul, for like who am I really, That's fine. It's beautiful. It's appropriate in many, many ways. And then, you know, the stern, like, fierce Buddhist punchline comes swinging in and says, yes, but it's actually the wrong question. If you want to be fully liberated, if you want to be, you know, if you want to get deeper satisfaction in this life, that's totally possible without doing too much with impermanence. You can just focus on, you know, building good relationships and good work and live in the world well. And it's a good thing to do. And you can do this for thousands of lifetimes and do much good in the world. There's nothing wrong with it at all. There's nothing wrong with the world at all. From that perspective, there's hella things wrong with the world. But not from a wisdom perspective. But if it so happens, and this is what happened to the Buddha, it's what happened to the founder of the Jain system, it's what happened to many, many seekers over the centuries, something seems to happen. And I have ideas about what it is. It's mysterious. Like, lots of people wandering around are not interested in liberation from a sort of classical contemplative perspective, from a yogic perspective. Folks are interested in other things, right? They're interested in, you know, like, healing from oppression, which is a good thing to be interested in for a very long time, and appropriate, and not lesser, right? And it needs to be said again and again and again. Having an urge for liberation is not better than other things, but it is radically different from other things. And the radical difference is that something seems to happen where people wake up just a little to the impossibility, the seeming impossibility of truly landing in stable, rested satisfaction in this life. Like, really, like, fixing enough of the ills that one's heart can truly land and feel at home or find refuge. Sometimes this happens when folks are get just enough healing from deep oppression that they surface a bit from the kind of panic of trying to keep it together, and they look around, and there's like, and this flame is lit in the heart that says, there's more than this. Often deep faith carries one through trauma and oppression, and then when any bit of respite or refuge is found, then the heart could open further toward, oh, if that's possible, profound liberation may also be possible. But the urge also arises when one falls from privilege. So if you've hung out with me for a while, you know that I think of trauma and privilege as two ends of a spectrum in terms of past karma. I'm not supposed to say the word karma on beginner's night because it's a very difficult concept. So if this is new to you, you know, hang with me for a couple minutes here. Bad stuff happened in the past. Its effects are still with you. That's called trauma. Good stuff happened in the past. Its effects are still with you in terms of like a layer of ease or well-being in different ways. That's called privilege. Neither one of them was your fault. Neither, you didn't earn privilege, you didn't sin to get traumatized. The whole system, which is a vast web of churning conditions, gave rise to those situations. Both need to be healed in order for liberation to happen. So trauma needs to be healed in order for the wounded to soften internally and externally enough to assemble the heart and mind in a non-distressed way, which is the path toward deeper clarity. Privilege needs to be healed, which really means coming out of denial and waking up to the reality of the world, coming out of the trance of comfort and into the reality of complexity and pain. And that's a healing. So waking up to the possibility of liberation happens when either of those poles comes a little toward the middle. Trauma is healed enough that the wounded can relax, and privilege is healed enough that the deluded can wake up a bit. And then there can be this urge of, like, there's got to be more than this. And somehow you encounter a teacher or a text or something that says there's totally more than this. But it's different than anything you imagined. And it doesn't consist of just continuing the healing path until things are pretty good from either direction. It actually consists in changing our relationship to existence entirely. And so impermanence is true in the way that, like, gravity is true. But you don't have to pay attention to it. The world just functions with gravity at its basis. But if you want to do something radical in relation to gravity, you have to assemble a lot of energy to reach escape velocity. Right? SpaceX just shot off a monster rocket, right? The biggest private rocket ever. It's a private space flight. So now, very soon...
Any rocket.
What's that?
Any rocket.
Private rocket. Private rocket, yeah. They're huge, huge, like big. You know, the Tesla of rockets. So, you know, bravo. Soon, like, billionaires will be able to go for pleasure rides in space. Cheers, billionaires. So I wonder, you know, I'm wondering about using escape velocity as a metaphor here. I only got halfway into it before. I haven't sorted it out in my mind yet, if it really makes sense. But here's the thing. Escaping gravity doesn't solve it, but it puts you into a radically different existence. And escaping impermanence, what does that mean? Impermanence never ends. Uh-huh. It just continues to be the nature of things. But your relationship to it can change completely when you reach escape velocity. I'll hang with that as the metaphor. I'm not sure I can defend it further than that. But to go back to this ancient debate, this is what it was responding to, was the idea that what we're looking for in the spiritual search is permanence. And it simply says you won't find that in any particular phenomena. You won't find it in the body, you won't find it in an idea, you won't find it in the subtle perception of energy, you won't find it in relationships, you won't find it in the earth itself. What you will find, however, that is strangely permanent is not a thing at all, but what would happen if everything you think of as having continuous existence through time, people, buildings, ideas, cultures, planets, souls, God, what if all of those things you were able to receive or be intimate with as they are, but let go of the idea of how they exist in time. Let go of the idea of continuity or permanence. So, like, here's this nice building, the warehouse. It was industrial, now it's a yoga studio. It's the consequence of many conditions. I first taught here when it was a different yoga studio, not as well organized or aesthetic as this one. It's been going well. How long will this building be here? How long will yoga exist as a thing people do in classes like this room. What if the building and the activities that take place in it and all the people that are here, that's y'all and me, what if we could try this on as a little exercise? Notice that all of it is here now, right? Yoga is what it is now. The building is what it is now. We are what we are now. And I don't even know how to tell you to do this, but try it. Just let go of the assumption that any of this is continuous. And you might connect with your visual field while you do that. And just see things and people. Don't stare creepily, people. But it's actually good to do this one almost like through your peripheral vision. I kind of soften my vision in my body. And I notice that with everything, as I identify it, there's a kind of solidification that can happen. I name something, clock, you know, bookcase, wall, whatever, the color red. And when I name it and identify it, it's almost like it goes ka-chunk in my consciousness and then doesn't move. Right? I see one of you that I recognize, and the recognition goes clunk. That's that person, right? That's Lauren, that's Molly, that's Peter. And as soon as I recognize and name it in a certain way, I don't continue to engage with its particularness in this moment. It's almost like recognizing things and naming them comes with an assumption that means I don't have to pay attention to it anymore, mm-hmm. in a subtle way. Right? I just know that you're there, and you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then, try not doing that. What happens? What do you notice? Anyone want to say what? It's subtle, right? Or impossible to do, which is probable, right? That recognizing things thing, that goes way back. Mm-hmm. Yeah? I was teaching a one-year-old to do that. Because you got to learn that things are things. And people, you know, yeah. So it's not easy to unlearn, but we have this phenomenal capacity to be conscious of the activity of our own minds. Self-consciousness is incredible. And what that means is that you can actually see, if you have a little bit of presence, if you're not too sleepy or anxious or unfocused, you can actually see this process happening. You can see something, and you can watch your mind assemble around it and kind of hang the thing inside a scaffolding of assumptions. And one of those assumptions is that the thing has been like this and it will continue to be like this. So one way to practice this, is to not think about things. Is to receive almost like the hit of something and hang out with just that. And what it feels a little bit like is like my being gets a little impacted. Like I see something and I don't overlay it with like, you know, name, you know, assumption, story, identity, projection, right? And of course, embedded in all that is all the big social confusions, right? Race, gender, class, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, liking, disliking, all that stuff. It's almost like it happens quickly. I perceive something and it kind of hits my being. And when conditions are ripe, sometimes I can just hang out with that impact and not do anything else, or at least bracket off all of that stuff. Of course it happens, right? I know your names, mostly. But I just sort of set it aside. And you can set it aside and then keep your attention with something. So now instead, there's a couple ways to do this. One is to really soften and sort of take everything in all at once so that you can't fixate on one thing and build the story of permanence on it. Another way, of course, is to pick one thing and land with it and not move. This is concentration practice, of course, right? You pick something, you land with it, and you don't move, and you let all of that information, in Patanjali's yoga, this is called the chitta vritti, all the modifications of the mind, all of the structures that assemble around contact. You kind of let them all sort of do their thing and ignore them, really. So any thoughts? Like, can you do it? What happens? What flickers through? Any insights? Yeah.
I noticed, it's probably partly because of reading that dream yoga book, but that there's this like sense, like looking, especially with vision, like looking at a wall and doing that, I kind of get this sense like in of sensing the kind of impermanence things too, that the, what I'm seeing is like not the thing itself, but just my perception of it, and it feels so fleeting that way.
Yeah.
And I get this like pang in my heart too, just mm-hmm. like, oh, like yeah, like impermanence is dissatisfying.
And yeah.
Like I really felt it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Carry on in that direction. Yeah. At least. Yeah.
I have a sort of an opposite experience with it. Yeah. That I find it calming.
Yeah. In what way? Let me say.
It's just still.
It's still. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It starts to turn out that the thing that seems like drama proceeding over time where there's a thing that's changing and has a whole story, that is a projection of my mind. That's me kind of laying all this stuff on it. If I don't do that, it's actually quite still. The thing is just what it is. And yeah, I've had versions of both of these experiences. Sometimes it just kind of like, if my mind's not doing much with things, there's just not much happening. Like the vast amount of things happening, it's just mental activity. The world is relatively still compared to the mind.
For me, it feels like a big relief, which is energizing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? A relief. Other people got relief. Right? What's like, up? What's fun. Up with that? Ah! It's supposed to be terrifying, but it turns out to be kind of a relief. Yeah. What do you get?
Yeah, that was my experience as well. It's like, oh, this makes everything so much easier.
It's so much easier. Totally, totally. Yeah, Peter.
For me, I what I can do is I sort of first I get like this, oh, this sort of spaced out.
Yeah.
And then I go a little deeper, more into it, the vibration.
Yeah.
Wow, 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 wow. Sort of like an LSD or something.
Totally.
This vibration coming. In the light and in and an audio, auditory, like a wah wah.
Yeah, know? Absolutely.
I hear a buzz. Or,
And that's classic, right? It's one of the perceptions that you can get, super trippy retreat perception, is that movement turns into a kind of ratchety feeling, because you feel you're tuned in so precisely to movement that you actually feel intention to move, like impulse to move. Movement, end of impulse, pause. Intention to move, movement, end of impulse, pause. And it goes clunk, 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 clunk. And so that's trippy. So yeah, all that vibration, you can sense that. It's totally happening. We blur over it. So all of these are really like, you got it. Like all of these are very classic responses to this. there's one big shadow to this kind of practice, which is that if you really get into, especially the non-focused part, but really either direction, the concentrated or the open focus, when there is trauma in the system where there's a tendency toward dissociation and freeze, this will amplify that. Because, you know, rather than going, you know, I will engage with the world and relationships and really contact the turning world, this takes you away from it a little bit. Because everything's just vibrating, fluctuation, right? And so for folks, for instance, who don't want to deal with relationship, you know, there's not really relationship in that space. Because beings are not consistent beings. They're just vibrating fields of energy. You know, tell that to your sweetheart when they're bugging you. You know. I know you think you're being really annoying right now, but really, you're just a vibrating field of energy, changing all the time. And I'm just resting at ease in the presence of vibration. Sorry. You know, so the shadow of this practice is dissociation, is like disembodiment, is not being engaged. And that's not embedded in the practice itself. The practice is not about fixating on the body, but it's either going to be a wisdom practice or a deluded practice based on the conditions that you're doing it in. And so if those conditions have been trauma and wounding around the solidness of the self and relationships, then seeing the radical impermanence of things is not going to be your practice. It's not the right practice, right? So if that healing from either of those fixated poles, trauma or privilege, has not yet happened much, like you're still really immersed in the symptoms based in those two extremities, this practice may reinforce a disengagement that is unhealthy. For this practice to be wise and liberating, it has to come in on a foundation of, you might get the sense, as we just tried it, substantial psychological stability. Yeah? Right? You want to be one who's like, I am totally comfortable in myself, in my body, like, not totally, you know what I mean, but like, substantially comfortable in myself, my body, my relationships, and I can do this meditation without, like, flipping out, having a panic attack, or thinking that I should, you know, like, end all of my human relationships and disappear into the ether. That's trauma, not wisdom. But when done with wisdom, all of those relationships and engagements, they do change form, right? They do become different than before, because so many of our relationships are founded upon, and our action in the world is based not in wisdom, but in delusion, right? This particular sweetheart will make me happy forever, right? This job will solve my worldly woes. I will get enough money to retire, and that will be safe from, you know, global calamity, right? Whatever it is, I will eat the right things so my body stays healthy. For how long? So this practice is supposed to destroy all your certainty in life, but it's supposed to do so once you have attained the stability of heart that makes it possible to do so and thrive having done so. When those conditions are met, and they're not impossible, like many of you have those conditions in place to do that. When those conditions are met, the result of this practice is profound, which is that it's actually quite possible to relate to beings and situations, fully recognizing their vibrating transience. But because of that, having the felt response, not of dissociation or distance, but actually simply of deepened compassion. And compassion is going to come when I'm in situations and I perceive that the energy in the whole situation around me is rooted in grasping and denial. And if my practice, for whatever reason, has opened me in that moment to something that is not grasping and denial, and I feel the relief of that, the profound relief of not clinging, the result is not that I kind of shrug and I'm like, clinger's gone cling, and I walk away, right? You don't become the kitten walking away from the explosion, as nice as that, you know, gif is. You actually become this thing that is not hardly that flashy, right? You become a good human being with other people, you know? Like, as soon as you're not panicking, there's nothing to do but serve. So in a way, the mark of non-trauma, the mark of wisdom rather than delusion, is that experiences of disillusion lead to the impulse to service and the feeling of compassion. When disillusion happens within a framework of delusion, its result is disconnection or flight, which is just a trauma response. You know, oh, now I'm going to leave the world. So impermanence has this powerful and central place in the Buddhist system. It says, recognize this as a deep inquiry that will change your life, and do so in the context of, you know, having taken refuge and clarified your ethical relationships, your ethical stance in the world, which means relationships, and all of the foundations of practice. And then just notice, kind of all the time, that everything is always new. And that every person you find yourself face to face with is brand new. You know their story, but this moment of contact has never happened before. And now it's gone. And we're on to the next one. So, like, you can take that perspective into your life in the world, and it changes everything, even as you're still working on the basic, you know, foundations. And if it happens to be the case for any of you or for anyone, you don't go and just preach this gospel to people randomly. But if this happens to be the case for you, that hearing this really is frightening or triggering, like if you really can't shake the sense that this means that relationships are empty or pointless, then the right thing to do is totally forget about it. Ignore it completely. Right? That's like saying to someone who's trying to learn to walk, to like think about the subtle complexities of gravity. Like, don't think about it. Just practice walking. You know. So don't think about impermanence if it's terrifying. But if it draws you to rest in this kind of state with people, and you can feel that it's connective and heartfelt, not blanking out, then you practice in that way. So.
This is like,
please.
It's almost like a disclaimer.
That's the disclaimer. Yeah. And more and more I want to give the disclaimer, because there's aspects of the early traditions, the early yogic traditions particularly, that are what we would call not trauma sensitive. Mm-hmm. You know. Even in a very simple way, you know, this teaching of like, oh, all conditioned experiences is marked by impermanent suffering, not self. That teaching traditionally would only be given to folks who had taken refuge. And taking refuge means you've actually already turned away from relying on the things of the world to satisfy you. And you've said, I'm going for refuge to something else, to the Dharma, to the teacher, to the community of practitioners. And those structures will hold me as I do my work in the world, rather than I go for refuge to, you know, a better wardrobe, a better bank account, a better, you know, even a better spiritual life, really. But just like, no, refuge to something that will actually sustain you through the dissolving process. So it's a disclaimer because, you know, these teachings are now kind of, I'm just giving it to you. Like, this is a very, very classical teaching. And I trust that you're here because you have enough of a foundation of well-being that could bring you here. But I don't know, always. And I've had students who have said to me, you know, flat out, like, I really want to work with you on healing. I don't want to hear anything about impermanence or not self. I'm not doing that shit. And I'm like, you got it. Yeah, it's not the right thing right now. Right? It's a medicine. And if you don't have the illness, you don't need the medicine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you share with me what it says in the scriptures in terms of how a practitioner perceives impermanence if they don't have the experience of permanence? I mean, how do you recognize it? What do they say?
If you don't have the experience of permanence, what does that mean?
I mean, how can I recognize that everything's impermanent if I don't have the awareness of things that transcend impermanence?
Right.
If I don't have the witness to perceive it, how can I perceive impermanence? I don't understand.
Yeah. What's the longest lasting thing you can think of?
See, I still have the crush on the person when I'm 7. I mean, I'm the same person, so I'm not thinking on the right wavelength.
So like, okay, you feel like the same person.
Yeah, I feel like totally the same person.
Right on, right on. And when you think of them, you totally want to get together with them.
I'm just them. What do you mean? Oh, when I think of the crush.
Like you now.
Right.
Do you totally want to get together with that little person, whoever that was? Not really.
I am together in my heart. I remember feeling that.
Yeah.
That whole thing.
But do you feel it now?
It's still a part of me, yeah.
But do you feel it now? The same feeling?
I think of it, yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. No, this is great. This is great.
No, it's that messed up. I do still get that, like, stomach thing and everything when I was, like, 8 or 9.
That's great. That's awesome, right?
I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So then, are you still in contact with this person?
No.
So.
No, totally in my head.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him in 55 years.
Cool. So imagine that there's this 55 years plus 8 or 9 years old. So imagine that there's this 64-year-old person that walks in the door.
Yeah.
It's them.
Yeah.
What might you feel?
So I had that with somebody else.
Yeah.
But that was a little older, like 14, 15.
What was it like?
It was really nice because he was a good person. I was proud of myself for loving him when I was a young person.
Yeah, oh, beautiful, right?
Is that bad?
That's awesome. That's beautiful, right?
And we both, like, recognized that we were, like, first loves, and it was... But we're not that now, and he's a totally different person, and that person who I love doesn't even exist, even in his body. It's like not...
You just answered your own question.
Yeah. But it exists, but I can...
Yeah, no.
I still get the flutter in my stomach.
Totally. But you just said it, right? You know, we both recognize that we were that for each other.
Yeah.
He, you know, he is a really good person, but he's a different person now.
But he's also the same.
So the inquiry then would be really look at it closely. And the question is it really the same? Or is it different because anything else is different, right? And you just stay with that question, with everything, right? Maybe it feels the same, but your body is different now. Maybe it feels the same, but you're married now. Maybe it feels the same, but they're different, you know? And then, is the feeling exactly the same? So the question, this is meant to be not like a believe it. The question, this is an inquiry question. And what it's meant to do is it's meant to be turned over in the heart, over and over, in a contemplative way. So you're meditating, you're walking. Mm-hmm. And it would be like, what lasts? Does anything last? What lasts? And you might be like, this totally lasts, this feeling, this idea, this sense of myself. And then you would take that thing that lasts, that you feel like lasts, and you would hang out with it and be like, and you would stay with it, and you'd be like, oh, is it the same now as it was 5 minutes ago? And if your first answer is yes, then you'd be like, okay, look deeper. And you just stay with it and stay with it and stay with it. And it's meant to reveal itself. And it can reveal itself, essentially, to be not strict to Buddhism, I'll say that it can reveal itself essentially in two ways. One is that nothing lasts. And two, that everything is constantly fluctuating, but there is a subtle reality that you could call God. Mm-hmm. And they end up meaning basically the same thing. Right? My feelings, my body changes, but one thing persists. And it's either so subtle that it encompasses everything, or it's so subtle that it encompasses everything in a different way. So it's an inquiry, and it's a great question, and you're not wrong for asking it. It's beautiful to actually be like, no, this is me. And then the response is, awesome. Be that thing fully, with concentration, over time. And maybe what I'll say also is, the only reason you would need to do this and ask the question is if it's haunting you in some way. In other words, if you don't have the seeker's question, there's no need to seek. If you're at rest, in whatever state, in your identity, in whatever thing, there's no need to challenge that because some doctrine says you should. There are doctrines that say you should do all sorts of weird shit, right? You don't have to do them, right? You would only do them because you have a profound impulse driving you to do that. And so if that impulse comes, then that inquiry will take root. And you'll be like, I can't rest. I have to know. And one of the monks I know said that you know, his practice essentially was, really this was a description of this monk by his fellow monks. They would be like, he just paces back and forth on his walking path outside his hut. And he's just like, he was just chewing on impermanence. Just being like, oh, you know, trying to get it. So that's what I got for you. I'm glad you asked. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you're here, too. It's a doozy. Because nothing is... outside of its realm. Yeah.
Do we have time?
Yeah. Go for it.
Okay. Yeah. I have a question about impermanence, like in the ways of relating to one another, whether it's the relationships or friendships or what have you. And I think that sometimes, like say you have old friends and you've known each other since you were young kids and now you're grown adults and kind of that same situation in which you had in realizing that you're different people, but you recognize that love that you once shared.
Yeah.
And then you get together with a friend, you haven't seen them in a really long time, and it's like you get together and it's as if nothing's changed.
Yeah.
And so there's that sense of, I don't know, this like permanent nature of like of connection and of being with one another, but then you see other people and you're like, you're expecting them to be a certain way and you're like totally bummed because everything that you remember is nothing.
Totally.
Nothing the same.
Totally.
And so I guess my question is, kind of, the question is also impermanent. you know, how do we relate to that feeling of, you know, as if nothing's changed, but then also realize that there's a sense of impermanence there? And, like, I see my best friend, and I haven't seen her in 2 years,
yeah.
and nothing's changed. And
right.
But then I also have to realize that she's a completely different being, because...
Yeah.
And
I mean, the inquiry would be, like, the feeling... It's good that the phrase is, it's as if nothing has changed.
Yeah.
It's the as if that holds the wisdom. Because, of course, things have changed, right? You've had all these experiences.
Yeah.
You are... You know, you're both a little wiser, you're both older, et cetera, all that. So there's something that's continuous and something that's changing. But the reflection on it maybe is really only necessary if you notice that you're suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're at peace with the whole process,
right.
like... You have this lovely friendship. Whatever happens is part of the unfolding of things. They move away further and can't visit. Someone dies unexpectedly. There's grief, which is appropriate, but not a kind of contractedness of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's even a contraction of heart, but that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in this system that says, like, don't love people. That would be terrible. What a stupid system that would be, right? It wouldn't have lasted if it was that way. And this profound openness to loving each other in this kind of understanding, in a really amazing way, because if I'm holding on to an idea that someone is a certain way, I can't actually fully love them in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not free to be different from that.
Mm-hmm.
But they, by the nature of things, are different from that. Therefore, I'm not seeing them clearly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not as generous as I want to be with someone. Like, I want to see you absolutely freshly, even if I know you for a long time and I'm tracing your narrative and
mm-hmm.
caring for you by tracing your narrative and remembering your story and being connected, whatever that is, in friendship.
Like the people telling you that you were once too.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful and necessary. That's called family, you know, and community. And, but grasping, you know, is what happens, you know, when that feeling shifts somewhat into, like, you know, like, oh no, the person I once knew is no longer that person.
Mm-hmm.
How could they do that to me?
Mm-hmm.
How could they do that to me? How could you change?
Mm-hmm.
I was relying on you being the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's grasping.
Mm-hmm.
And so when there's grasping, impermanence will lead to suffering. When there's non-grasping, impermanence is just gravity. And, you know, people do what they do over time. You know, and these beautiful Dharma relationships, you know, happen, especially where both folks in a friendship or a relationship or a community of people actually are practicing together, being present with a body of understanding like this. And that just will affect how we are with each other. You know, it affects... one of the reasons I love this tradition so much is not that the doctrine is brilliant, which it is, or any number of things,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that more than any other body of discourse I've seen in the world, the people who immerse themselves in it are good people, and they behave wisely when death comes. The Buddhists are really good when each other dies. Because we've been thinking about it the whole time in a certain way. And it's really, you know, something changes in you when you're not afraid in that way. Or when you know you're afraid and you're okay with that. You know, and that's the process.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, go with the as if nothing's changed. As a marker, that's really just a metaphor, but or a whatever, it's a you know, a turn of phrase. Go with the feeling of loving someone for a long time. And then, and this is beautiful, what happens when you let your love for someone be completely awake to impermanence? And then, like, you're not loving a fixed thing, and they're not loving a fixed thing, but love is actually just what's happening. Mm-hmm. And then that's a lovely way to be with someone, right? And that's really a deep practice of being intimate with who's actually in front of you, mm-hmm. you know, rather than my idea, my projection, my, you know, my story. So thank you everyone for being here. Blessings. Thanks for attempting to contact profound emptiness with me for a moment there. Great. Carry on practicing in that way. Do come out to Spear Rock on Saturday if you like, or come and do movement practice and pranayama with me. Love to do that practice with any of y'all. So, gifts in support of this group in the wooden box in there or at the front desk. And again, thanks so much for being here.